Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, and we are here on July 20th, 2018, here on Friday. I hope you guys had a good Independence Day. I guess there was a show last week, but we might have recorded it before Independence Day, so secretly, this is the first one we recorded since then. Hope you guys had a good holiday. We're going to get to Meg Rowley and Chris Herring in a second, but first, just wanted to talk about our sponsor today, Dollar Shave Club. And of course, you know, if you listen to this podcast before, that Dollar Shave Club, it's about more than what's going on with shaving. It's about whatever you need in the bathroom to get ready on a day-to-day basis. You can buy all of that at DollarShaveClub.com. You know my favorite's the One Wipe Charlie. You know what it's good for. In case you don't, it's for wiping your bum. It is fantastic. It's a life-changing experience if you're using the toilet. But there's more than that. There's a shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, calming body cleanser. And it's well scented, it's comfortable, it looks classy, I might even say, relative to what you're going to get at the store. It's not garish, it's not trying to stand out, at your big box store, because you're getting a good deal, you're getting a good product. You don't need to have it be this garish color. It's going to be something that's going to look good in your bathroom, and it's going to look good on you. It's top shelf ingredients, and it's not going to break your budget. And shipping is included with your membership. So now if any of those interest you, I would say just the One Wipe Charlie's alone should interest you, but whether it's anything related to your bathroom, it's going to interest you. For just $5, you can get Dollar Shave Club's Daily Essential Starter Set today. It comes with the body cleanser, the One Wipe Charlie's, those butt wipes, their world famous shave butter, and their best razor, the 6-Blade Executive. You can keep blades coming for that for a few bucks a month, throw in shampoo, toothpaste, anything you need for the bathroom. You can check out all that at dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. Check it out today. And we have a couple things to talk about. Not much football going on. We'll get to a tiny bit of football later on with this first guest, but wanted to talk about a few transactions in a few different sports when it comes to American sports. And let's start with Major League Baseball at the halfway point of their season. And joining us to discuss that is frequent contributor to the podcast, my friend Meg Rowley of Fangraphs. Meg, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. As always, you've talked about several different topics for us. We'll get to another topic, the Seattle Seahawks, a little later on in this segment. But first, let's talk about, obviously, the Major League Baseball trade deadline. There's been several trades already. And the biggest name in the market's already gone. Manny Machado has gone to the Los Angeles Dodgers for 5 players. So let's just start with the Dodgers perspective here simply. How does this shift their lineup around? Is it just as simple as saying, well, he played shortstop for the Orioles, let's just plug him in at shortstop every day and we'll go from there?
I think it might be that simple. We can get kind of galaxy brained about this, and obviously they have so many options in the infield. It's so stacked that, you know, we might see some moving around and some shifting if things, you know, for some reason go awry. But I would imagine that Machado will be the shortstop every day. We'll probably see Chris Taylor assume a role at second. I would imagine that Logan Forsythe is not long for that Dodgers roster, which probably means, Max Muncy at first base, and then possibly shifting Cody Bellinger to the outfield. You know, they have a pretty, in addition to this incredibly stacked infield, have a really deep and dynamic outfield, especially with Andrew Toles coming back. So it gives them some flexibility if they want to make another move. But when you think about having to deal with that Dodgers lineup, I mean, pretty much 1 through 9, it's going to be amazing. Well, not the pitcher, not nice, but it's a pretty incredible infield, and I would imagine that the rest of the NL West is pretty irritated that they were able to pull this off.
Did you have that moment where you felt like you were going to get angry messages on Twitter from people saying, oh, the Dodgers don't have great hitting pitchers? Did that actually come up in your brain as you were correcting yourself there?
Yeah, I don't know that we have to cater our lives to the worst of our Twitter mentions, but sometimes you can avoid some heartache if you address it in real time. So
that seems certainly fair. How bad has Machado been at shortstop versus what we saw from him in the past at third base, where he was a really talented, now, of course, the bat was there, but also a very talented defensive third baseman? Do you think has he been bad enough at shortstop, or is he projected, I guess, to be bad enough at shortstop that it could really impact, the obvious boon his bat is going to offer to the Dodgers?
So I would say two things about this. The first is that, our defensive metrics at Fangraphs, and I think this is pretty true across the various advanced analytics around defense, have Machado's defense at short is very, very poor. Mm-hmm. I think it's good to remember that there can be a fair amount of squishiness in half season samples of defense. So I would venture to say that, one, his defense as it has actually been in the first half is probably not quite as bad as what the metrics are suggesting. And I think that long term, he's probably going to be fine. I mean, some of this is just a positional adjustment for him going back to short and sort of shaking off the cobwebs there. So he's not a premier defensive shortstop right now, but I don't think he's as bad as the numbers have suggested. And I think that long term, he's probably going to be fine. So no, I don't think that it's going to be the sort of thing that makes or breaks the Dodgers. And like I said, they have a fair amount of flexibility in that infield. So if they really wanted to get creative around the defense, I suppose that they could. But I don't think it's going to be the kind of thing that ends up mattering that much. And, you know, for him, it would be really nice if he could have something of a rebound in the second half, because it seems as if he wants to go onto the free agent market as a shortstop. And if he had, you know, a half season of sort of better numbers, he could insist on that a bit more. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But I think it'll be fine for him and for the Dodgers.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fine for him on the free agent market either way, I have to admit. It would be interesting, though. I mean, the idea that he's going to be playing shortstop for the Dodgers for the rest of the season, and presumably the Dodgers would maybe like to re-sign him after the year if things break right. And, well, they already have a shortstop in Corey Seager. So I don't know. It's weird that he could be, you know, having a half season at shortstop for the Dodgers, and then if you were theoretically at least to re-sign there, which, again, unlikely but possible, you know, he would probably have to then change positions, or they'd have to move Corey Seager, I guess?
Yeah, I'm not convinced that the Dodgers are the team with the greatest need for Machado in free agency. You know, it's interesting because on the one hand, yes, he seems to want to play short, and obviously the Dodgers have Justin Turner at third. He signed through 2021, and Machado's really young. So, you know, I could see a scenario where maybe they decide to, I don't know, get creative with how they're positioning guys in the interim, and then maybe look to have him assume third base once Justin Turner sort of runs away and comes off of his deal. So I don't know, but his free agency is going to be so interesting because you have to assume whoever signs him is going to have to back up a Brinks truck to do it, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to make a pretty substantial amount of money on the free agent market. And you would imagine that the deals that he'll receive would be pretty comparable team to team. I think that his market's going to be, there's going to be a fair amount of consensus around it. And so it'll be interesting to see sort of what beyond the money Machado decides to prioritize is being able to stick it short, something that's going to matter to him and be sort of decisive in his decision making. Is some team that's maybe a little further away from contention but getting close going to offer him a lot more? Mm-hmm. Or is he going to prioritize going to a team that, you know, is going to be in postseason consideration right away? So I love to see what ends up mattering to people apart from the money, which is a good thing to matter, to be clear. I wouldn't fault Machado for prioritizing that. But I think it might be an interesting test case for us in terms of what guys think of as important beyond just the contract.
Mm-hmm. So the Dodgers sent five players to the Orioles, and it's a variety of prospects. They avoided most of their top prospects going, but one guy who is going, who maybe the most notable player going to Baltimore, is Yusniel Diaz, who the LA spent $31 million to sign out of Cuba in 2015. The Dodgers, of course, in the past, they signed Hector Oliveira and then traded him after paying him a $28 million bonus to Atlanta, I believe, in the Alex Wood trade. The Red Sox, of course, to Yoan Moncada, the plate trade for Chris Sale, after paying him at least a good chunk of a $63 million deal. I mean, the rules are changing when it comes to spending for international free agents, and will certainly still be under evaluation. But is there something weird here about, you know, sort of these huge market teams using, you know, what really is sort of uncapped spending? And of course, there are rules, but, you know, uncapped in a way that perhaps the draft is not necessarily capped in the same way, and then using those international free agents to trade for star players. Is there something you think MLB has to consider addressing here?
Well, they've pretty much addressed it already. I mean, the caps in the CBA, in this most recent CBA around international bonus pools, are hard caps now. So in the past, you know, part of the reason that these bonuses end up getting so big is that, or the total spending on a player like the guys you've mentioned gets so big, is that you're paying penalties on top of the bonus itself. Right. And so MLB has taken away the ability of teams to do that. I mean, I say MLB, teams, you know, say what they want, and they want to pay international players less. So this is being done at the behest of the league and teams. So I think that if you want to think of it as an advantage, and it is a way that a team like Los Angeles or the Yankees can sort of diversify the way they both acquire talent and then how they deploy that talent to acquire other talent. Mm-hmm. And that has been largely reined in. It is interesting, you know, the Orioles are sort of famously adverse to pursuing anything in the international market. And even this week, they've indicated that sort of franchise-wide position is going to shift as they recognize that they sort of have to play in that space in order to maximize the talent that they have access to. So I think that as a particular advantage, you're going to see it sort of decline for teams like the Dodgers or the Yankees. But the Dodgers maintain a lot of other advantages, right? I mean, some of the other players who went in this deal to the Orioles were drafted in later rounds. You know, they're, you know, eighth-round guys. Mm-hmm. But because of LA's player development, they have blossomed into real prospects that were worthy of inclusion in a package for someone like Machado. So yes, the particular money advantage might be diminished somewhat under these new rules, but you know, smart teams that are also rich always have a couple more advantages than others. So as much as it might pain other fans of other NL West teams, I think that the Dodgers will find a way going forward.
Dodgers will find a way might be the title of a good Dodgers book in the future. So the Orioles, yeah. You mentioned, I mean, in the midst of a rebuild here, 28-69, that's a bad record. You would figure this is not the end of their trading period. Zach Britton, of course, someone who's come up a lot in terms of possible trade rumors. Adam Jones had some rumors before this past week. And, you know, even though he's on the final year of his deal and has a big contract, you figure the Orioles might eat some of the money and possibly trade him somewhere. Should they be more aggressive than that? Should they be looking at guys like Kevin Gausman and Dylan Bundy, who's still only really 24 years old, to you know, try and rebuild, just thinking that those guys are not going to be meaningful parts of the next contender Orioles team?
So I always feel bad for fans when I say things like this, because it is such a bummer to go into one of those long, bleak rebuilds, and sometimes a guy like Dylan Bundy, who's, you know, not a superstar by any means, but is a respectable major leaguer, can make a big difference in the lean times. But if I'm the Orioles, I mean, there's just very little here that is, I think, going to be a part of the next great Orioles team. And so I would imagine that, I don't know that they'll be able to pull it off, but I would imagine that they're in conversations for pretty much anything that isn't nailed down. And they do have, you know, a couple of contracts that are going to be a lot harder to move. And so as a means of acquiring talent, I think, you know, guys like Britton, you know, Kevin Gausman, if you can get anything for him, and even Dylan Bundy, it's going to be painful, and it's going to be a long rebuild. As a Mariners fan who faces her own very long rebuild on the other side of this window of contention, I have a lot of sympathy for Orioles fans, but I think that they have to start to think about the future, because this particular iteration of the Orioles isn't going anywhere. It's really not good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Kevin Gausman was a useful major league starter as recently as 2017. He was a two-win starter last year, according to Baseball Reference. Dylan Bundy, the numbers aren't necessarily great, but still striking out almost 10 guys per 9 innings. There's something there. I mean, let's say if they package Bundy or Gausman or someone who has at least some marginal value with Chris Davis, who has the worst contract probably in baseball, or certainly one of the worst contracts in baseball, 4 years and $68 million left for a guy who's been worth, at last check, negative 2.5 WAR from Baseball Reference. Is there any amount the Orioles could get back? Like, would they have to eat Chris Davis's entire contract to get rid of it as part of a Dylan Bundy contract? Or do you think they could possibly get a prospect of any note back in return?
I think they would have to eat a very significant portion, and they're unlucky in that, well, that's a strange way to think about it, a major league team. They get to be a major league baseball team, so they're doing great. But they're, you know, they have this additional consideration in that he does have a limited no trade clause. So the number of teams that they can move him to is limited to begin with, and then you add just how bad that deal looks in hindsight, and sort of where his production has been. I think it has improved maybe marginally. I haven't looked at his numbers this morning, but there was a while where he was literally the worst position player in baseball, and he was having almost a historically bad year. And so I don't know, if you're not eating the majority of that contract, I don't know quite how you move him. And I think that guys like Bundy could, you know, they could fetch prospects on their own. So I don't know. Gosh, what a sad Orioles team that'll be. Just like a bunch of guys you don't know the name of, and Chris Davis being sad, contemplating his choices. Ugh. Sorry, guys. It's going to be rough.
It's going to be rough, but there is a bright side on the other side of the rebuilding period. We've seen some teams this year really emerge as contenders in Major League Baseball. Teams, of course, are going to be interested in Britton. Relievers, of course, are going to go for a high price this time of year. And we saw two relievers come off the market earlier this week when the Indians traded for Brad Hand and then Puyallup High School prospect Adam Simber. Adam Kimber, am I mispronouncing his name? I apologize. Adam Simber, I believe. No?
I think it's Kimber.
Like, I think it's Kimber. Oh, man.
I'm pretty sure.
I tried two different ways and it was wrong. I should have looked that up before. I apologize.
Still don't that's feel- a name. Mm-hmm. Don't feel bad, because until yesterday, I was aware of Adam Kimber as a human person who plays baseball, mm-hmm. and I would have sworn in front of a judge with my family's well-being on the line that his name was Adam Kimber, and it's definitely not that. That is definitely not his name. So sometimes you just get one wrong, and you just move on.
Okay, well... I appreciate that you're reassuring me. But the Indians, they had the top lefty in hand and an emerging righty in Kimber with his really solid numbers this year in his debut season in Major League Baseball to a league that, or to a bullpen that has been one of the worst in baseball this year, which is strange, no?
I mean, I don't think that any of us anticipated that it was going to be this bad. And obviously, Cleveland has suffered from not having having Andrew Miller for long stretches this year. But it's been atrociously bad. Mm-hmm. And for a team that, you know, has a fair amount of cushion by virtue of playing in one of the worst divisions in the history of baseball, a truly historically bad division, mm-hmm. It hasn't mattered too much up until this point. I think that we have their playoff odds at Fangraphs at something like 99%. But it's clear that they needed to address the bullpen if they were going to do much of anything in the postseason. And so I'm shocked that it was this bad. You know, they were sort of one of those teams where when a lot of teams around you are doing badly or tanking, maybe we could say, or in some process of rebuilding, the incentives in division to add a bunch of, you know, new resources to the team are a lot lower. And I was critical of Cleveland in the offseason for doing that, but I assumed that it was going to be a problem on the position player side, not the mm-hmm. pitching side. So this is, you know, been a very surprising stretch, but I think that, you know, they did exactly what they needed to, and I am glad to see them spending resources to address a situation that was getting pretty untenable and was likely to limit them pretty severely against teams like the Astros or the Yankees or the Red Sox in the postseason.
Do you think they were right to sort of hit that point of no return and say, even though we're getting Andrew Miller back, even though we're going to have him, you know, as part of this bullpen, we can't sit here and trust guys like Cody Allen and Zach McAllister and Dan Otero, who have been good for us in the past. We just can't trust them to be meaningful parts of the postseason bullpen right now.
I think that one of the most important things that a franchise can do in baseball is have a really accurate understanding of what their windows are. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's to Cleveland's credit that they properly have understood that, you know, they have sort of not a super limited window. They obviously have young, dynamic players on the roster, but in terms of that sort of core group really coming together and staying together, it's the next couple of years for them. And, you know, as talented as Mejia is, and he is a very talented prospect, I mean, the Padres got a good one in this trade, he's probably not going to be part of this core. He's blocked right now mm-hmm. With Yan Gomes on the roster, and blocked for good reason. I mean, Gomes has been quite good. So I think that they accurately understand where they sort of are going to be over the next couple of years, and know that this team, this next couple of years of teams, are going to be their best chance for something in the postseason. And one of the things that they got in addition to two relievers who are really good right now is a couple of years of control in those relievers. So it also gives them some cushion, you know, as you think about guys like Andrew Miller going into free agency and, you know, not necessarily being part of their plan for re-signing, that it gives them some options once guys like him come off the books should he decide not to return to Cleveland. So I thought it was a pretty savvy move, and I think that, you know, I know why we hug prospects. I mean, I'm a Mariners fan, so I'm pretty unfamiliar with the idea of
you
liking
shove
your
prospects away.
Yeah, because it doesn't often turn out super great for us in Seattle, but I understand that inclination, but I also think that you need to understand where your team is, and Cleveland clearly does.
Yeah, Francisco Mejia ranked fifth on Keith Law's midseason prospect list published just before this trade. So, I mean, it's a legitimate top major league prospect for two relievers. But, I mean, those guys are signed for years to come. Hands and signed it, what, through 2021 with options, no?
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Yeah, and then Kimbrough's just in his first year. So, I mean, these are guys who could be part of this bullpen for years to come. And certainly now two dominant lefties in that bullpen. Is there anything else you think the Padres might be trading off in the before the trade deadline?
I wouldn't be surprised if they move a couple of other pieces. I mean, the Padres are in sort of an interesting spot because they have this their farm system is incredibly stacked now. And, you know, I don't think that anyone thought even with the just completely uncontroversial signing of Eric Hosmer that they were going to be in a position to contend this year, but their sort of window of contention is rapidly approaching. I mean, they're coming up on it probably as probably a fringe, maybe dark horse wildcard contender next year, and then getting really into the meat of it, coming into 2020. So they're not super far away. And you know, it's always nice to have new and better prospects. I don't think that anyone who's on this current Padres roster, with the exception of maybe a couple of the very young guys, are going to be, you know, the backbone of this next great Padres team. So I think that they'll be opportunistic, and if they have offers that they like, you know, this year is lost to them, and they knew that going in. So I wouldn't be surprised if they make a couple more moves. But their sort of biggest and most valuable assets seem to have moved away already. So I would imagine that it'll be, you know, sort of more marginal moves. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the addition of the second wild card spot is sort of, whether on purpose or not, do you think it's accelerated the rebuild time for teams because they are in a way closer to contention than they would have been in years past, because it is a little easier to get into the playoffs with that second wild card spot than it would have been, you know, under the previous wild card rules?
Yes and no. So I think that what we tend to see, or what I've observed, is that you get a lot more teams. The A's aren't a perfect example of this year, but they're kind of close. So you get more teams who sort of mid-season see themselves as closer than they expected to be to the postseason and will start to get aggressive at the deadline. So obviously the A's haven't made any moves yet, but they've indicated publicly that they are open to acquiring talent in a way that they probably weren't even a couple of weeks ago based on their recent play. So I do think that you get more teams to sort of throw their hat into the ring mid-season. But I think that for a lot of these guys, what you'll tend to get is they'll sniff around, and if they're a lot closer, maybe they make marginal moves. The Brewers from last year are a really good example of this, where they had sort of arrived early and were much closer to a playoff spot than I think a lot of people anticipated them to be going into the season. And there was talk going into the deadline that they might make some big moves, some pitching acquisitions, for example, to sort of put themselves over that line early, but they didn't end up doing that. And I think that a lot of teams are pretty clear-eyed about what the real sort of time frame for rebuild is. And as much fun as a wild card berth is, they're not really inclined to jeopardize the longer term sort of potential division winning team for a temporary, you know, sort of one game playoff appearance. So I think that it tends to affect teams in what is a rapidly shrinking middle class a lot more than teams that are close to sort of being contenders, but not quite. But then you also get teams like this year's Phillies, who were very active in the Machado market and tried very hard to acquire him and aren't quite there, but are pretty close. So there are always outliers, but I think in general, teams are pretty careful. And, you know, it's not as if the deadline is the only time that they can acquire talent. So I think that they also try to get a good sense of what the market is. And if they're going to be asked to pay too much, they can always wait until the winter, which is something we saw the Brewers do this past year, where they really saved their big acquisitions for the offseason and then you know, felt good about where they were and made some very savvy moves. And I imagine that they will be one of the teams that tries to be active in the pitcher market come the deadline this year.
Mm-hmm. So with the deadline approaching, is there, whether it's feasible, whether it's infeasible, is there some fit of player and team you just love? Like, you think it's just a good fit, but you think it's probably not going to happen just because it's tough to pull off for one reason or another?
I have two that kind of come to mind for me. So it's not quite clear yet how active the Mets want to be at this deadline. I wouldn't be surprised if they do, if they don't really do much of anything, just because of the sort of disarray, you know, obviously for very sad reasons that aren't anyone's fault, but like the disarray that their front office is in at this particular moment. Mm. But, you know, the Brewers could really use a good starter. So could the Cubs for that matter. And Jacob DeGrom's a good starter.
Checks out.
He's pretty good at pitching and seems very keen to get out of New York, at least out of Queens. So I would like to see him move, but I would be surprised if it happens. If you're the Mets, I think it's kind of hard to justify trading DeGrom and not Syndergaard, because what are you doing? Are you in or out of being in some sort of rebuild, soft or otherwise? Mm-hmm. So I tend to think that, you know, given the givens, that he's not likely to move, but I would think that he would be, I mean, he would obviously make any playoff team who's sort of in a playoff position now instantly better, and he could be a real difference maker for some of these sort of fringe wild card teams or teams that are in tight division races. But I think it's going to be tricky. The other one that I, you know, don't expect to happen, I imagine it'll wait until the winter just because of what the price is likely to be, would be Real Muto in Miami, who is very good, is easily the best catcher available on the market and one of the best catchers in baseball at a position that is very, very thin. And you look at a team like the Nationals, who have gotten really poor production out of that position. I mean, he seems like a natural fit for them, but they have been very clear, at least publicly. Now, teams fib about this. Yes. Oddly enough, they do not reveal their whole trade strategy in public in advance, but they have at least said publicly that the prospects that it would probably take to get someone like Real Muto are not on the table, at least not right now. So I would like to see that for their sake, but I doubt that it's going to happen.
It is fun to think about what a Jacob DeGrom, Noah Syndergaard trade would look like if the Mets packaged them both to someone who wanted, I guess, two really good pitchers.
Well, I doubt that. I don't know that there's a farm system in baseball. Do I think this? I think that there's not a farm system in baseball apart from maybe like the Padres that could fetch both of them. But I don't see a ton of point. I don't assume that they'll go to the same team, but I don't see a ton of point in trading one and not the other, just because I think it's good for organizations to sort of, like I said, know where they are in their window, and trading one but not the other seems a bit, you know, half in, half out. So, It would be fun, though. I think, you know, he would, I see DeGrom in a Brewers uniform for some reason. I don't think it's going to happen, but I don't know. Something about it, maybe it's because some of their uniforms also have pinstripes, and so it wouldn't be such a huge departure.
Yeah, the idea of someone escaping Queens to go to Wisconsin is very unlikely, so I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know anything about that.
So, final question for you, Meg. As a Seahawks season ticket holder, I have to ask you, USA Today published their projections for the 2018 season, and the most notable projection had the Seahawks going 3-13. What would your life be like if this happened, and what are your expectations for the Seahawks as a smart fan when it comes to the 2018 season?
Well, thank you for thinking I'm a smart fan. I am just a fan, though. So I have heard from smart football people who know it really well that when you have a really good quarterback, you're always sort of in it. And the Seahawks have one of those. And as much as, you know, we spend half of our day refreshing Twitter to see if Earl Thomas is going to return to the roster, at least in theory, they'll have an Earl Thomas who is aging, but still really good at football. And so it seems as if they have both of those things, and, you know, they have some young guys who, you know, people who actually know stuff about young guys in football seem really excited about. So 3-13 seems pretty aggressive, even in a division like the NFC West, which is admittedly, like, annoyingly good.
Yes.
as a fan, even though I, you know, I'm excited, I guess, that it'll be more competitive. But that seems aggressive. I don't know. I'm always sort of in a weird spot with football, just as an enterprise mm-hmm. and an idea. And so I think if a Seahawks team went 3-13, I'd probably be able to just let football go at that point.
That just seems nice.
But I suspect that they will limp along and do something better than 3-13, and then I will have to sit with my angst about the concept of football generally and the Seahawks team in particular for another year or two.
Well, nothing is more promising than that. Meg Rowley, of course, you are can be found on Fangraphs and the Hardball Times. But where can people check you out besides that?
I'm on Twitter telling very bad jokes at Meg Rowler and occasionally on the Fangraphs audio podcast, and then just here with you whenever you'll have me.
Wonderful. Well, Meg, thank you so much for coming on. We're going to hit a break. Come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. Guys, the trade deadline is coming up in Major League Baseball. And, of course, there are going to be a lot of teams sending a lot of scouts out looking for talent. A lot of prospects are going to get dealt. Some veterans are going to get dealt as well. There's an easier way. I understand teams want to spend a lot of money. That's their prerogative. But your business doesn't have to do that. You can use ZipRecruiter because ZipRecruiter is going to find you the right candidates with just one click. It is so much easier than sending out a bevy of scouts to try and find someone for the open job you have at your company. You don't have to pray for the right people to see it. You don't have to just post your job online and just guess and hope you get an okay candidate. You're going to get great candidates with ZipRecruiter. They've built this platform that's going to help find the right candidates for you today. And they're going to invite them to apply to your job. You don't have to find them. ZipRecruiter is going to find them for you. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And they let you know what the best applications are. So you're not going to be sifting through mediocre matches. They're going to highlight the best matches for you. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. So right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. The way to do that, just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, and you will find candidates for your job today. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, back here on the show, another regular contributor to the podcast. Happy to have him back on. 538's Chris Herring. Talk about the suddenly active NBA trade market. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to talk about this NBA stuff. I was on vacation. I saw the Kawhi trade happen. I wanted to talk about it with someone smart, and I said, let me ask my friend Chris Herring, because he is someone who actually knows what he's talking about when it comes to the NBA. So let's just start with that, because I know from my perspective, as a naive outsider, I was stunned. I just dropped a pin. I was so stunned to see a Kawhi Leonard deal actually happen. I always figured that the Spurs were going to figure it out, or that they were going to take the risk of not losing him, and he was going to be in a Spurs uniform come the 2018 season. Are you surprised it actually happened?
You know, I think I moved past the point of being totally surprised. I mean, part of it was that, you know, the regime, not the regime, but the era is kind of changing and turning over at this point. You know, whether or not you feel like that enhanced the likelihood of them keeping Kawhi Leonard. Tony Parker mm-hmm. signed a free agent deal with Charlotte, and it was like, wow, that's a big one. You know, and obviously they lost Tim Duncan a couple years ago to retirement. Manu's kind of been on the fence every year to about this point, if not a little bit later, mm-hmm. about potentially retiring. And they, you know, they've traded away some of the other guys that you thought of as potentially being part of their core long term, like Kyle Anderson. And so at this point, you know, the team is going to look different. They don't have as much talent coming back. LaMarcus Aldridge had a nice year last year in Kawhi's absence, but at some point he's going to slow down. And really, I think the big thing for me, when you're considering leaving the sort of money on the table that Kawhi was doing mm-hmm. by even introducing the idea of bringing about a trade request, that's pretty considerable at that point. Because, I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. about what would he have been eligible for, something like 200-something million as mm-hmm. far as the extension or whatever it would have been. When you're talking about leaving that sort of money on the table and walking away from a supermax deal just because you want to play in another market, you know, by all means, he should do that if that's what he wants to do. But when you're talking about leaving that kind of money on the table, it kind of felt like it was beyond repair to me, especially because of what you're saying, because the Spurs always figure it out. We'd never even heard of any sort of complaints about this sort of thing before. Greg Popovich acknowledged last year that LaMarcus Aldridge was the first player he's ever had that's really requested a trade, especially of that caliber. And so the idea that, you know, 1 year behind that, that Kawhi is not only doing that, but potentially sacrificing that much money to do it, kind of told me that things were in a bad place. And, you know, a lot of us have kind of heard for months that the Spurs didn't like kind of the tone of some of this stuff because they felt like he was trying to angle his way out specifically to one or two teams. And so I think they were bothered by it. They obviously still wanted to hang on to him, but at a certain point, you've got to kind of make something happen. It doesn't make sense to roll the dice and, you know, run the risk of him leaving, especially if he's kind of screaming that he wants to get out.
Mm-hmm. So we don't, of course, know which offers the Spurs actually had on the table, but it did seem like they went after getting a veteran player as opposed to just sort of totally blowing it up and trying to get as many picks and sort of, you know, promising prospects as possible. And, of course, they ended up getting DeMar DeRozan as part of this trade on only one protected first-round pick and only from 1-20 with the possibility of it turning into 2 second-rounders. And do you think that's a more logical path for them, given where they are, as opposed to sort of trying to just blow it up immediately and just going after, you know, younger players?
I was a little surprised by the return on this trade for the Spurs, just because, look, DeRozan is a very good player. Mm-hmm. By no means is he, you know, I think a lot of people would probably view this like, in some ways, if you take out the injury part of it, if we're assuming that Kawhi is actually healthy, the Kyrie Isaiah Thomas trade, in some ways, it kind of, that's probably not fair, but like it, on some level, it kind of feels like that if both people were healthy and totally healthy, that the gap between one player and the other, it feels about the same. Where like Kyrie, you know, we saw that Boston could be a top-ranked defense with Kyrie, whereas you probably can't do that with Isaiah Thomas in your lineup. And the same is true with DeRozan. If he's totally healthy, he's a very good player. He's going to score for you. He's not going to always be a total liability on defense, but, I mean, we're talking about maybe the best defender on the planet. When he's fully healthy and engaged, and particularly when he's playing with other good teammates, he's incredible. You know, the first back-to-back defensive player of the year winner we've had in a long time. So I just think at that point, you know that the best player in the deal is Kawhi. And even though DeRozan is very good, Kawhi is the best player by a mile in the deal if he's healthy. And the idea, you know, at this point, I haven't really heard people talking much about his health. More so, it's just kind of been the idea that he doesn't want to play there. So I don't have quite as many concerns about his health as, you know, looking back at what happened with Isaiah Thomas. But looking at that part of it, you know, figuring that Kawhi is much better than DeMar DeRozan if he's healthy, and the idea that this is just one first-round pick and it might be conveyed into 2 second-rounders, like you said, I was shocked that there weren't more pieces to this than what the Spurs ended up getting back. You know, Jakob Poeltl is totally fine, a good, solid player, very smart player. You listen to Zach Lowe talk about him, very cerebral in terms of the way that he talks and breaks down the game. But, I mean, the Raptors had a couple players on that roster that were younger, that have upside, that aren't necessarily stars or, you know, don't necessarily project to be stars, but could be solid players and maybe better than Poeltl. Obviously, Anunoby was one of them, someone that had the task of guarding LeBron James as a rookie in the playoffs. And kind of fits kind of the Spurs culture, a 3-and-D guy and someone that, you know, that can take on that sort of defensive task. They've got, you know, they have Pascal Siakam. They have players on this roster that you kind of figure the Spurs, I would have probably really wanted or kind of demanded that they've been part of the trade, particularly because of what Masai Ujiri was saying earlier today in his press conference, the idea that, look, we love DeMar, but at a certain point, you can't keep running out the same group, and we've got the window closing, and now LeBron's out of the conference. You've got to kind of make a move now. So Toronto was never going to have an opportunity to add someone of this talent level. You could have probably held firm and gotten more out of them, I would think, especially because there was only one pick there. Right. I know Toronto didn't want to do that because Kawhi hasn't committed to staying in Toronto and may not like it there, but, man, it just feels like you would figure they could have gotten a little bit more. I'm surprised they didn't.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Spurs type being, you know, sort of 3-and-D guys, and Is it weird that, you know, we're sitting here in 2018 and the Spurs are still held up as one of the model franchises of the league, one of the smartest, most progressive thinking franchises in the NBA, and yet their two best players are LaMarcus Aldridge and DeMar DeRozan, and those are two guys who really spent a ton of time in the mid-range. I mean, DeMar had to be prodded to shoot more threes this season. Is it, do you think that's a fit that can work in this modern league?
It's interesting. I mean, they've been successful like that for a while now. I mean, that year that they won the 67 games, they were either second or third in the league in terms of mid-range attempts. And so, you know, as easy as it would be to say that it can't work, I mean, that's one team that has made it work. And I think part of the reason they've made it work so often, too, their offense hasn't always been totally elite, but their defense has. And so you can kind of get away with certain things and kind of having a slightly different structure on offense. Mm-hmm. You know, at a certain point, you know, last year they were the three, the four seed for most of the season until they kind of went through that rut at the end of the year and just kind of barely snuck in. But if your defense is that good, you know, maybe you can get away with being a little bit less conventional on offense. You know, the mid-range thing, like you said, is mostly a product of LaMarcus Aldridge. He takes basically more contested twos, long twos than anybody in the league. DeRozan's right there too. And so, you know, I will say that DeRozan's not bad at them, neither is Aldridge. It was a positive step that DeRozan was taking more threes and in particular was, you know, was making a high enough percentage of them to where it made sense for him to do that. Maybe they'll prod him into taking more with the Spurs as well, because it's a team that, you know, gives guys the green light to do that sort of thing. But, and, you know, kind of piggybacking off what I just said in the last response, they also gave up Danny Green here, which, you know, just in this deal, and it just, you know, to me was just kind of a head scratcher. The Spurs are still going to be too good to really tank at this point. And so it's just odd to me that, you know, you would give up someone that still is a useful player. And I think some people would call him better than useful, you know, understands the culture there. You still got a lot of young players that are going to be learning, under Pop's tutelage here. And so, you know, and I wrote a story about how Greg Popovich calls far more timeouts in the first 2 minutes of games than anybody else in the league over the last 20 years or so. And, you know, the first person I talked to for the story was Danny Green, because he basically has kind of been Pop's whipping boy in some cases. The idea that he, you know, Pop can kind of shout at him and Danny Green takes it because he knows that he's been there so long, and that if Pop is allowed to do it to him, that Danny Green can kind of lay out an example for everyone else of just kind of how to accept criticism and no one being bigger than the team, despite how many titles they've won there or how long they've been there. And so you lose people like that over time, and it starts to, you know, it starts to chip away a little bit at the culture, even though if you view it as like a top-down sort of thing. Pop is coaching a relatively young team at this point. I mean, Aldridge is there, Gasol is there, but a lot of these guys that they're going to be trying to build around are younger. So maybe that's why they get rid of Danny Green, but I was surprised to see that too, because it just felt like there was more talent going out on one end on the other.
Yeah, absolutely. So from the Raptors' perspective, I mean, you're looking at the Eastern Conference right now. You have LeBron going west. The Celtics, I mean, there are injury issues there. There's still a very deep team. The Sixers, again, there's always going to be injury issues surrounding Philadelphia. And this is suddenly kind of an open conference. Do you think, I guess a two-part question, do you think they make this move if LeBron stays in the East? And then do you think this is a move worth making for the Raptors, even not knowing that Kawhi is 100% healthy, perhaps, or that he 100% wants to play in Toronto even this year, let alone in the years to come?
So the second part first, yeah, I think the gamble made sense regardless of whether he stays. And part of the reason, I mean, you know, you've kind of heard my take here on DeRozan. He's a good player. He's not a generational sort of player. I wouldn't put him in that category at all, and I don't think anybody would. Kawhi, you could make the argument, kind of is. We've written about him before at 530. He's basically the most balanced star, superstar in the league, and, you know, can change games and change the way an offense operates, sometimes almost to the Spurs' detriment because of how good he is on defense, because teams will run their offense so differently with Kawhi out there. So clearly you get a player of that caliber kind of with where the Raptors were. They were kind of stuck. Even if, you know, even if they'd known that LeBron was going to stay in the East, I think maybe this would have made a lot of sense for them to have done this anyway, because this would have been one of the only chances you had. Now, what makes it interesting, the better question, I think, would actually be, do you fire Dwayne Casey if you know you can make this deal? Mm-hmm. Because this is a guy that won Coach of the Year, and you fired him. And so, you know, and I think a lot of people kind of looked at it and said, well, it's a lot easier to switch out a coach than it is to really change your core, mm-hmm. particularly one of your top two players, particularly the money that they're making. And DeRozan has so much money left on his deal. I think his deal was for 5 years and $139 million. And so that's why I don't necessarily blame the Raptors for doing this anyway, and I don't think it's a huge loss. Yes, they're going to take a step back if Kawhi leaves, and it'll be a significant one. But I don't know that you had to pay DeRozan to kind of stand pat on the off chance that LeBron did leave, because you would have had a shot this year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not sure that that's a deal you want to be out, you know, having to pay if all of a sudden the Sixers and the Celtics run away with this thing in the next year or two and kind of run the East for the next 10 years. What good does it do you to be paying DeRozan other than the idea that you keep him in one uniform and, you know, the fans obviously love him there. DeMar loved it there. And it sounded like they kind of made a commitment to him that they wouldn't deal him. And so that's the unfortunate part of it here, is that it's clearly a business. It always has been. But no, I think that this is something now where they do have a chance to win the East. And you could have at least spun it to say that you had a decent chance of winning the East if you'd had Kawhi, even if LeBron had stayed out East, just because that's a sizable upgrade if he's healthy.
So we were talking about the Kawhi trade, and we were planning this, and then a second trade happened. Carmelo Anthony went to the Hawks. He's not going to stick there. He's going to get bought out and then go to free agency. We'll get to him in a second. But package sends Dennis Schroeder to the Thunder, saves them nearly $100 million, I believe, over the next several seasons for luxury tax reasons. So let's start from Oklahoma City's side. They clearly wanted to get rid of Carmelo. They gave up a 2022 first-round pick, kind of protected in a similar way to the pick that the Spurs are getting in that trade, where it could be a second rounder if it doesn't transfer in that first year. And they get Schroeder, who sort of lost his way, it seemed like, in Atlanta. Do you think he can revitalize his career in Oklahoma City, given that there's a pretty imposing figure at point guard for them in Russell Westbrook?
I think he can, but I will say this. One thing that started to frustrate Russ and frustrate Durant, and if you remember, I don't know that people remember far back enough, but Reggie Jackson, you know, there were reports that he kind of didn't want much interaction with the team after all, because he really didn't like his six-man role there. He had, you know, a lot of production in Oklahoma City, and, you know, the idea that he would shoot baskets on a totally different end of the floor than everybody else when he was practicing with the team and everything. And the idea that he just was kind of isolating himself because he felt like he deserved a bigger role. Now, no one would, in their right mind, would say that he's more valuable than Russell Westbrook. But, you know, maybe he felt like he was outgrowing that situation in that scenario. Mm-hmm. So Schroeder, I don't necessarily know that he's like that, but, you know, the idea that to some extent that maybe somebody can become a malcontent or just can be brutally honest about the idea that they want more for themselves. You know, he did an interview with a foreign outlet at one point, and he was kind of talking about what teams he would be a good fit for. I think he mentioned Milwaukee you know, during the playoffs or something in a foreign interview that he did. And so, you know, maybe he just really wanted out. Maybe Atlanta already knew that. My assumption is maybe they did not, and that kind of hurried this sort of thing along. But, I mean, he had become a starter in pretty short order. He'd been in Atlanta and played very well as a backup. You know, once they kind of moved into a new era, he became the starter there, and he scores very well. I mean, he's actually one of the best ISO scorers in the league last year. You know, his effort kind of wanes here and there. But if he plays his role there, I mean, Oklahoma City was one of the worst teams in the league with bench production. Mm-hmm. Raymond Felton was a decent backup point guard, but he's kind of aging at this point. Even though he had a good season last year. I mean, this is kind of there for the taking for him. Having a guy that can score 20 off the bench for you, particularly if Westbrook is having an off night, I think is a good move for them. I think it's a pretty decent gamble for them. I actually like the deal for both sides because obviously you don't want to be stuck paying the luxury tax for someone that, speaking of malcontents, that Carmelo, you know, had made it very clear he didn't intend to come off the bench there. Mm-hmm. Didn't really play that well in the one season that he was there. Struggled to kind of adapt to what they were asking him to do. but I, you know, I like the fact that they get a useful player and someone that theoretically fills a need for them, if he's willing to kind of make it work and to work hard there. And obviously Carmelo gets to move on to a new situation as well. It won't be in Atlanta, but you know, Atlanta made sense for them to kind of move on from Schroeder if he didn't want to be there. Mm-hmm. Then they get a pick out of it. So it made a lot of sense, I think, for both teams.
Mm-hmm. So what doesn't make sense to me, and again, I'm hoping you can explain this to me because you're the expert here. The Carmelo, I think, is going to be a free agent, and the favorites to sign him at the moment are the Houston Rockets. Who, again, another person a lot smarter than me is Daryl Morey. And I understand that there might be some reason to bring him onto the roster, but he does not exactly seem like a guy who fits both what the Rockets want to do around James Harden and Chris Paul, and a guy who's going to fit the Rockets on the wing, where he's presumably going to be replacing guys like Luke Bamute, who's left this offseason. So sell me on this move. I mean, is there a way you can see Carmelo actually having a positive impact on the Rockets in the seasons to come?
So what I will start with is this, kind of two parts to it. One, if this was up to me, and, you know, I think Daryl Morey is smarter than I am too, but it doesn't mean I don't occasionally question kind of what they're up to over there. Mm-hmm. If it was my call, you know, I think Trevor Ariza and Luke Mbamute, the two of them together are, I think, more useful than Carmelo Anthony by mm-hmm. himself. I think even if you had Luke Mbamute and Carmelo, you know, and instead of Luke Mbamute and Ariza, I still think I would probably prefer the first two instead of having Melo and one of the other two. Mm-hmm. That's how solid those guys are or can be on defense, particularly when you're in a series with Golden State. I think Carmelo could be a big liability against a team like that. And so a lot of people were kind of stunned that that those two guys walked, particularly Mbamute. Mm-hmm. You know, Ariza got a big money offer from Phoenix. So, I mean, that seems more of a luxury tax question, and it became very interesting when you looked at what the Rockets owner said, where he was like, that never was a discussion about luxury tax payments and, you know, worrying about that. So I find that somewhat hard to believe because the basketball part of it didn't really seem to make sense to let those guys walk mm-hmm. if money weren't an issue. So that's the first part. You know, I would prefer to have those two instead of having Melo. Definitely Melo by himself, but even Melo with one of the other two. Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side of that, I do think there's a universe where Carmelo can play well in Houston. They obviously wanted him last year and just couldn't find a way to make it work money-wise. They needed somebody to take Ryan Anderson off their hands. You know, he makes about $20 million a year, mm-hmm. You know, way more than, you know, what most people would be willing to pay him now if he were on the free agent market over again. The problem, I think, for Carmelo last year, part of it was that he still wanted to play like the old Melo and wanted to stop the ball. And, you know, they had three stars there, three guys that had been stars before. And so there was kind of the your turn, my turn sort of thing. And Melo had to grow out of that. And eventually Russell Westbrook did and stopped kind of, you know, trying to play nice. He just kind of took over games the way he did. Paul George had a great season. Melo was kind of the odd man out. And so eventually, like, he and Billy Donovan had a conversation about kind of taking more of a spot-up catch-and-shoot role, and he had games where that worked really well. He had games where it didn't work as well. Mm-hmm. But what stood out to me and stands out to me when I watch video a little bit, and some things that kind of make themselves clear in the numbers as well, Carmelo's always been a really, really good spot-up shooter. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times he doesn't get good spot-up looks in the past because he was with the Knicks, and he was the best player out there. And so teams weren't going to come off him defensively to give him a good shot when he was the best scorer on the team. That wasn't the case last year, so you figure he would have better looks, and in some cases he did. But what I would critique about Oklahoma City and what Billy Donovan actually said a time or two was that Oklahoma City wasn't really a good passing team. And Russell Westbrook, despite the fact that he obviously has averaged a triple-double for 2 years in a row, mm-hmm. He's not a great passer. Like, he obviously generates a lot of assists because he's got the ball in his hands a lot. He finds his teammates, but a lot of his assists are kind of dump offs to Steven Adams and the guys around the rim. He's playing so fast, and that's obviously something that isn't a secret, that he oftentimes kind of doesn't hit people square in the hands with his passes. And, you know, you'll watch Carmelo Anthony kind of have to crouch down to catch a pass. He'll have to move two steps to his right to catch a pass. When Russell Westbrook drives and then kicks the ball out. And so that's something that, you know, when you consider the fit in Oklahoma City and all the adjustments he had to make with that already, and then the fact that Westbrook, you know, I think some people would say that he plays a little bit out of control sometimes, that his passes aren't always the most accurate. That probably wouldn't be much of an issue in Houston, because I look at James Harden, and I've written stories about this, that he might be the best quarterback in the NBA. Obviously, LeBron would have a very good argument as well. But the two of them, and then especially somebody like Chris Paul as well, that these are guys that do not play at a really, really crazy fast tempo. They're not, you know, generally sprinting past people. Incredibly, incredibly accurate about where they put the ball. And, you know, you get the impression that's something that they either study or that they're just naturally good at, just kind of hitting guys right in the numbers or in the hands with their passes. So I tend to think that that would help Carmelo. It doesn't mean that he would revert to, you know, to being, you know, a guy that was one of the best spot-up shooters in the league as of 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the other thing maybe he gets more of in Houston than he would in Oklahoma City, the idea that the Rockets get more wide-open threes than any team in the league. Wow. And that's a product of their spacing. And so Carmelo would probably fit into that very nicely. But, again, that's kind of, to me, that's kind of like the last hope you have for Carmelo being a good productive player again, is the idea that maybe he's playing with better passers. Because let's be honest, we watched the Warriors and the Rockets play, and we watched people force switches, you know, with James Harden repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And the same thing was happening with Carmelo in that series that they played against Utah, where Carmelo was getting switched relentlessly, and they were trying to force switches onto Carmelo defensively, and he got just skewered the whole series. And that was why he wasn't playing a whole lot towards the end of that series. So there are real issues with fit, I think, almost anywhere he would go. But, you know, I do think there is kind of one last ray of hope for him. And it's, you know, Chris Paul and James Harden are better passers than Russell Westbrook, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Mr. Herring, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Where can people check out more of what you're working on?
Almost everything I write, at least the long form stuff, is at 538.com. And my Twitter handle is Herring_NBA.
All right. Recommended follow from my end. Always a pleasure, Chris Herring. I'll be back on, I'm sure, closer to the NBA season to talk about stuff. But thanks so much for hopping on today.
No problem, man. Thank you for having me, as always.
All right. Thanks so much to my guest today, Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, Chris Herring of 538, talking baseball and basketball. I'll tell you what, the NFL season is coming up. I think next week we're going to start talking about the 2018 NFL season to come. We got some famous guests from the past, some celebrities, as you might say. We're going to have some interesting ideas that we've run in the past. Player props, of course, one of them coming up in the weeks to come. Some team previews, all kinds of good stuff happening. So more football coming on the Bill Barnwell Show here in the weeks to come. Thanks for listening.